Hello, Lopez. I'm Lorna Reese, and I'm here today for the Lopez Writers Guild with a new radio show, Lopez Writers Read. Those of you who have attended any of our Writers Read evenings at Lopez Center know you have a treat in store for you, because we'll be bringing you your friends and neighbors reading from their own writing work. In each program, we'll talk with the writers about their work and their process, and they'll read a couple of pieces to us as well. This particular show is being pre-recorded in May 2009. Our guest today is Julie Van Camp, who has a new book out. It's called Searching for Ichabod. His 18th century diary leads me home. Julie's book knits 30 years of historical and family research into the seams of a contemporary journey of discovery. Julie Foster Van Camp was born and raised in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, the daughter of a Washington County farm boy turned pediatrician. She has a bachelor's degree in journalism from the University of Iowa and a master's in criminal justice from Northeastern University in Boston. She's been writing for years. Her articles have appeared in Ancestry, Western New York Heritage, New England Ancestors, the Christian Science Monitor, the San Francisco Examiner, the Judge's Journal, and various American Bar Association publications. Her books include Courts and the Classroom, Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts in Boston, and State Courts and Law-Related Education, Phi Alpha Delta Law Fraternity, Washington, D.C. After retiring in 1992, she moved to Lopez Island, where she writes and volunteers as a nonprofit management consultant. Julie, welcome to the show. It's really good to have you here.
Thank you. It's fun to be in this building. It's fascinating. I recommend it to anybody who hasn't been inside the radio station.
This is only my second interview, so all of this is kind of new to us. And Julie has never been interviewed in the radio before, right?
Never before.
It's a fun experience for us both. Well, let's talk about your book. How did you come to write this book? I mean, where did the idea originate?
I came to write the book after I had written probably three or four magazine articles, and my Lopez Island book group said, "You have a book." And I guess I took the bait and turned from writing 15-page articles into about a 230-page book. And it was kind of a daunting process, but they kept encouraging me, and I would say, off and on, it's been a 10-year process.
Well, even writing the articles, I mean, what was the germ of the whole, of the articles that led to the book? Tell us that later.
Well, no, I'm kind of bitten by the genealogy bug a long time ago, and it probably lends itself to my interest in law and solving cases. And I had a real case to solve, because my uncle had given me information on four generations of my family, and then he had also told me about a book that had been written about the Fosters, that's my maiden name, as ones who founded Salem, Massachusetts in around 1635. Well, there was a missing gap in the middle of this, and it kind of became the challenge of, you know, nailing in the golden spike in Utah. I had to complete it. I was going one way, and there was this gap. And we were living in New England at the time, but I had three young children, and I just didn't get onto it right away, because it was probably 1974 that I was first interested in doing this. And there was just no evidence to prove from the notes I had that my great-great-grandfather, Elbro Foster, was actually born in Rutland, Vermont, 1785. No records in Vermont at all about his birth or his father's death. I was just running into brick walls, but I just kind of kept going.
And after the kids were grown and you got to Lopez, you started writing. Is that when you started
the first magazine article was published in 1997.
That must have been pretty exciting, too.
It was, to see, you know, my name in what was a very well-known, it's Ancestry magazine that many people who do this work know. It's published out of Salt Lake City. It's the Mormons' big publication.
It's a lovely, glossy magazine, isn't it?
Yes.
With pictures and everything? Yeah.
What fascinated me about that article is the Mormons are real sticklers on proof. you know, mm-hmm. date, place, name, everything had to be documented. Mm-hmm. Well, I sent them this book based on my legal background and proving the connection to the missing link by circumstantial evidence.
Oh.
Without actual written proof of a birth, I just proved that Elbro had to be Ichabod's son based on the census records, and in those days, that was the first census. Mm-hmm. And Vermont's first census was a year later than the rest. It was 1791. And they would not name children. They just said male child from 0 to 5. You know, and this was the only foster family that Elbro, if the notes I had were correct, mm-hmm. could have been born into. So they printed it. And then the book shares how I located his diaries. I'm not going to reveal that because I'd like people to buy the book.
Okay. Well, this has been a really long process, and you said you really got a lot of encouragement and maybe a little bit of a push from your writing group. Did you ever feel like giving up, or were you always just encouraged to keep going? I mean, I get the idea doors kept kind of opening for you.
They did, and when I realized that what the book would be a first-person present tense of my experience retracing Ichabod Foster's life. He was born in 1740 in Attleboro, Massachusetts, and I followed based on his diaries. So I got to a point where the hardest part was when he left Vermont and migrated when he was 71 years old to western New York in the Holland Purchase lands and walked 600 miles with his wife in a wagon. To make those points interesting, he would note in his diary where they stopped every night, the name of the person, and trying to find those little towns today, even though I stayed on the New York back roads, I was saying, is there any story here? And there were times when I thought, who really cares about this but me?
Right.
And so why bother with the book?
Well, that leads to another question that I have. It seems like most genealogy-oriented books are dry, straight historical fact. But your book is a departure, it seems, in that you are writing about your personal journey to find out what happened. So it's like you married memoir and genealogy. And so how did you decide to write it this way, and were you encouraged or discouraged from doing it that way?
I think as I decided, I had all the names, dates, places, and all the typical genealogy information, that this was just plain dry. And having been a journalist in my other life, writing third-person reports about other people, I thought, you know, there's more. There's a story here. And so as I was reading Ichabod's diary, I just became fascinated with American history at that time. Mm-hmm. So the story started to evolve of my family's role in this history. I mean, they were in the Revolutionary War, but it's a battle you'll never hear about in a history book. Happened the same day that Burgoyne surrendered at Saratoga.
Mm,
October October 17, 1777.
Yeah.
But their little battle was in Pittsford, Vermont.
Yeah.
So it was the common man's story that intrigued me. Ichabod Foster was a farmer. Mm-hmm. He made his shoes, you know, he had a cure for everything.
Really?
And I thought, oh, was he smart? He's a doctor like my father was.
Oh,
but he just, and I would read these notations in the diary, and then in my research, I found old almanacs that were written at the same time that had the identical cures. The
really?
Man just read the almanac, put it in his diary.
Yeah.
But he applied it to his family, and he inoculated his children. And
From smallpox?
Yeah, yeah. Mm. It was fascinating that he had done that. It was called Kleinpox then. It was cowpox, like.
In PBS aired John Adams. Mm. You could get this through Netflix, everybody. And in one of the episodes, they show how they inoculated themselves against smallpox. It
mm-hmm.
was quite frightening.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, I mean, a lot of things in those days were quite frightening, it seems to me. And people just kept putting one foot ahead of the other and doing what needed
mm-hmm.
to be done.
Yeah.
Well, so you didn't have any qualms at all about making this like a more of a memoir than a genealogical story? And I ask this question because I know someone who is also a genealogist, and that was one of the things she wrestles with, is how can she put herself in this in the story, or she's been told by a lot of people in the field not to.
I attended a writing workshop on the encouragement of John Sangster, which was in Port Townsend.
Mm-hmm.
Centrum, And I took the prologue to be workshopped. And that's when they said, get rid of your little darlings, the people you want, kill your darlings, and get yourself into it.
Ooh.
And that was the hardest part with my journalism background. I'm not in it. I'm telling somebody else's story, and who wanted mine? And then I had to get somewhat emotional, because otherwise it was going to be flat.
Yes.
And that was probably the biggest decision. Could I do that?
Yes.
But they said there's no story without it.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody's genealogy is different, and your motivation for it is different.
Mm-hmm.
And mine was just personally trying to fill a gap that turned out to be more than just a gap on a page of records of births and deaths. It just was a gap in the deaths that I had experienced in my own family and the need to find Ichabod's grave.
Mm-hmm.
Where was he buried? And
well, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
I think, well, one more question, then I want to hear something from your book. You've recently returned from a book tour in New England where much of your search takes place. I just wondered how that experience was for you going back there with the book to all the places where you did research and got help and encouragement. Mm-hmm. And
what happened really, I think, is I've got another story, article, 15-page about the return of Ichabod. I literally took the story back to the people who made the story. Those that sponsored me are people who are in the book, you know, or the scenes are from their town.
Yes.
And so I was either sponsored by a bookstore or a historical society. And the thrill of those people to be in a book. These are simple people, like Ichabod is simple.
Yes.
When I was in Whiting, that town still only has 441 people and probably 2,000 cows now.
Mm-hmm.
But that's about the population when Ichabod lived there in the late 1700s.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the same people, you know, their ancestors are there. The same families are there. Ours just moved west.
Yeah.
That was thrilling to see that and experience children coming to the readings.
Mm-hmm.
And being thrilled. One child said, an author came and she wrote about Whiting. Oh, they feel so famous.
Yes,
and
yes.
It's the one-on-one, the personal experience that that really made this so rewarding, and to just have them gobble up the book, and it's, you know. Mm-hmm. And Ichabod's farmhouse is still there in Whiting, and this is all described in the book. And the woman who lives there moved in 1944, and she told me on the book tour, and we only paid $1,000 for it. It had no plumbing or anything.
Oh, boy.
So that was a thrill to see her. She's in her late 80s now, and she came to the reading. One of her sons brought her, and sitting there with these little fifth and sixth graders, they were just in awe of her.
Mm-hmm.
And that blending of ages to appreciate genealogy.
And I'm guessing too that some of the people who came and listened to you or that you met along the way would maybe get even more interested in finding their own family.
I think that's probably true. Yes, mm-hmm. the book, as one professional genealogist has told me, if you read this book, you will know how to find your genealogy, because I do it not by telling people, but by showing them what I found in census records and digging up the land deeds and, you know, and pursuing it. When you run into a dead end, look at it in another angle and you might find an answer.
And for you listeners out there, all of us writers are always told to show, don't tell. Well, Julie, would you read a section from your book for us now? And tell us what you're going
to
read.
Okay, I'd be happy to. The book, the prologue is written in third person, and that launches the story that leads into the two-week search as I follow his life. So I'll read the prologue, because I think if I started at some place along the journey, people wouldn't understand why I was on the journey.
Sounds like a good idea.
All right. The prologue is entitled Proof Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. A washed-out sign leaning into a ditch informed me I was entering Whiting. I was driving north on Vermont Route 30. The year was 1992. Clapboard farmhouses and towering feed silos dotted the sprawling fields. The horizon burned in brilliant blotches of red and streaks of purple and pink, blending behind the black silhouette of the Adirondack Mountains. I passed a white colonial-style church with a cemetery behind it, several houses in need of paint, the town clerk's office, and a general store. Pastures speckled with Holstein cows spread across the broad valley. Was this all there was to whiting? I turned around in a farmer's driveway and retraced my route, looking harder for more evidence of the town. The afternoon light was fading. I had no motel reservations. In fact, I had not seen a motel since leaving Rutland. My fuel gauge was bumping on empty. I came to a filling station offering grinders and gas and pulled in. A middle-aged man wearing bib overalls, a plaid shirt, and a cap advertising hybrid seed corn was resting against a stool behind the counter. He was thumbing through a magazine. "Do I pay first before I pump?" I asked. "Sorry, lady, I haven't had any gas for 3 months. Not since water got in my tanks." "Is there another station in town?" "Nope. This is it. You might find one open in Middlebury." "Which way is that?" "About 12 miles over yonder, north." "But I'm not going that way. Where might I find a place to sleep?" He stood up. I watched his hazel eyes drift across the dirty window pane. Chewing on the side of his mouth, twitching his thumb on the counter, he said, "Well, I hate to tell you, lady, but you're in the boonies. There ain't anything around here. But over east in Brandon, there's a nice inn. Don't know if you'll find gas there at this time of day, though." He stared at his black, dust-covered rotary dial phone, as if wondering whether it was connected to anything. "Would you like me to call the inn, see if they have a room?" he asked. Moments later, he assured me that a bed and gas were waiting for me in Brandon. A scratchy weather forecast coming over his radio said, "We could expect another sunny April day tomorrow." I was warming up to whiting. "What you doing up here in these parts anyway?" he asked. "Searching for my ancestors," I said. "Ichabod Foster settled here in 1784. "So did my ancestors. Maybe we're related." "I'm Guy," he said. "Maybe so," I said. "My name is Julie. I believe Ichabod was my great-great-great-grandfather and had a son born here in 1785 named Elbro and a grandson named Azariah in 1811. I told Guy that I had driven hundreds of miles over the past 20 years searching for my ancestors. I had tramped the ground where their logs became cabins and their clear cuts grew corn. I had rummaged through 17th century land deeds in Salem, Massachusetts, marriage records in Coventry, Rhode Island, and probate abstracts in Taunton, Massachusetts. I had studied census data in Medina County, Ohio, and vital records on a German island in the North Sea, and fading photographs of Iowa relatives. Clutching my magnifying glass, deciphering tiny old English script, I had followed clues. "You're a traveling woman," Guy said. "I pretty much stay right here in Whiting." "Hope I see you tomorrow," I said. "I'll be visiting the town clerk in the morning." Guy stood in the doorway as I walked to my car. "Thanks for finding me a place to stay," I said. I had trouble falling asleep that night. I don't know why. Images of people and places emerged from like old 16mm films, clicking, missing, refocusing, almost visible, almost hidden. I remember traveling in our shiny blue LaSalle with my parents and my older brother Jake on Thanksgiving morning in 1946. I was 9 years old. Our destination had been the Iowa Homestead Farm in Washington County. We passed Amish families in black horse-drawn buggies churning up dust along the gravel road. My father fretted about his clean windshield. Edging over to the culvert, he stopped, jumped out, and wiped it off with a rag he always kept in the glove compartment. After a quick pass over the hood, he slid back behind the wheel. Thanksgiving dinner was waiting. The Foster family ritual seemed like Norman Rockwell material. Dinner was served at the townhouse in Wellman, after which we traveled the few miles to the farm purchased in 1860 by my great-grandfather Azariah Foster. Aunt Mabel, her round face beaming, her apron a little off-center, pushed open the swinging dining room door and placed a huge turkey platter on the table. The succulent brown bird was a fresh kill from the feeder lot south of the barn. Uncle Elry carved. The sideboards were crowded with bowls of creamed corn and scalloped oysters, mashed potatoes and brown gravy, tiny garden peas, coleslaw sprinkled with paprika and cherry and orange jello molds brimming with nuts and tiny marshmallows. Rhubarb, apple, pumpkin, and mincemeat pies filled the corner table. We gathered to celebrate family, faith, and the fall harvest. My father and his four brothers, those five sons of Hyla Ann Jones and Henry Lucas Foster, sat, legs crossed, on the living room sofas, methodically lighting, relighting, puffing away on their pipes and cigarettes. Aunt Laura refilled their coffee cups. Laughter filled the room as they relived childhood adventures on the seemingly endless Iowa prairie. Nearly 30 years later, shortly after my father's death in 1973, I returned to Iowa from New England with my husband and three young children for one more Thanksgiving feast in Wellman. My father had been a pediatrician who diagnosed young patients with appendicitis but neglected the growing pain in his own stomach. He drifted into a cancer-induced coma and died shortly thereafter. 8 months before he died, my brother Jake had hooked a hose to the tailpipe of his car. The engine was idling. He pulled the hose inside. The windows were shut. When he didn't arrive home for dinner, his wife drove to the foreign car dealership and found him on the back seat. Bank records showed he had delinquent loans. When my father's ashes were placed in the crypt next to Jake's, I cast about for something to hold. My mother's hands were wrapped around her own pain. Her electric shock treatments and months in mental institutions during my childhood had maimed our fragile connection. We couldn't talk. I felt a cold, empty crevasse splitting open, swallowing me inside. I was falling without a rope, my spirit spinning out of control. Knowing there was no one to hear me, I cried silently, trying still to be the perfect daughter. Could recreating my Thanksgiving memories fill the void I felt, help me feel the presence of my brother and my father once more on the farm, pass on a tradition to my young family? After our traditional feast, my children curled up on the living room floor. I sat on the nearby sofa sipping coffee with my Uncle Warren. I asked him if we had any family history records, especially ones stating causes of death. The Foster Bible was destroyed in a farmhouse fire in 1923. As if on cue, he reached into his shirt pocket and handed me three small, tattered pages. He slipped his pipe from his lips. "Here, I think you should have these." His blue eyes twinkled as if they hid a family secret. He never said why he was carrying the notes that day. The fragile pages listed only birth, marriage, and death dates for four generations. The notes were written around 1902, when my father was 5 years old. "Elbro, my great-great-grandfather, born October 16, 1785, in Rutland County, Vermont, was the last name mentioned. His parents weren't listed." "Who were Elbro's parents?" I asked. Uncle Warren didn't know. No clues remained. "Why me?" I asked. He smiled. "Take good care of these notes," was all he said. When I finally found time in the 1990s to focus my research, those five foster farm boys were dead. I regret not caring when I should have, when I could have recorded firsthand accounts of life on the prairie and asked my father what he felt when fire consumed the farmhouse, or when he trotted his bay mare over the fresh snow to his one-room schoolhouse. These stories were silent. But could I uncover other family stories among the records in the towns like Rutland and Whiting, where Elbro was born? Would I find another foster farm, a birth record, a death certificate? I had to try. My census research had shown me there was only one foster family in the Rutland area in 1791 with a male child to match Elbro's age range. I decided to seek the missing pieces that might prove, beyond a census assumption, that Elbro was Ichabod's son. Shortly after 9 o'clock the next morning, I pulled up to the Whiting town clerk's office located next to Guy's station. A round-faced, middle-aged woman with deep blue eyes looked up from her desk behind the counter. "I'm Grace Simons, the town clerk. Can I help you?" she asked. "I'm looking for the birth record of my great-great-grandfather, Elbro Foster," I said. "I believe he is the youngest son of Ichabod and Susanna Carr Foster." "So you're looking for your relative," she said. "Many people are these days. Are you a Foster? You must be the one who stopped at Guy's yesterday. A stranger isn't hard to spot in Whiting." Grace flew on autopilot without a verbal release button. Her energy, like a transfusion, breathed life into my travel-weary bones. Her husband's family had lived in Whiting all their lives and had started the Brandon Inn after the Revolutionary War. Inside the small one-story frame building was an L-shaped room with a counter separating Grace from the reception area. A room behind her cluttered desk was jammed with metal shelves containing volumes of dusty books. Moments later, she was lugging a stack of land deed records from the vault. Together, we scanned grantor-grantee indexes for the first three volumes. Ichabod purchased and sold hundreds of acres of farmland between 1784 and 1805. Grace also produced a card file that had no record of Elbro's birth or Ichabod's death. She opened a drawer containing a copy of an 1800 map of Whiting. Farmhouses appeared as black squares with the owners' names attached. Grace stared at the map. There's Ichabod Foster, right under that square. That farmhouse is still there, on the old Crown Point Road, she said. I reached for the map like a lifeline, a link to a family I thought was lost. The veins in my hands tingled. I couldn't utter a word. Was I going to walk across Ichabod's cornfields and sit in his parlor? And I go on to visit the farmhouse that day.
That's lovely and really exciting. I can't imagine. I know that my family, I can trace one side back to 1256 or something, but that's because they never left the town in Norway. They were there for hundreds of years, so there was no search involved. That's amazing, though. I love a mystery, and you really got one there. This is Lorna Rees. You're listening to Lopez Writers Read, and we've been listening to Julie Van Camp reading from her new book, Searching for Ichabod. His 18th century diary leads me home. Julie, I'm one of the lucky people who got to read your book, so I know that it's full of surprises that you encountered in your search. Can you tell us about a couple of them? Maybe even one that surprises you still today?
Well, there's an awful lot of serendipity in the search for ancestors, and people that I meet will say they feel like they're in the room with them, and it's they can't explain it, but when you're so involved in it, it's kind of there. As I traveled following Ichabod's route, and it took me 2 weeks, and his last part only took me 5 days, but it took him 5 weeks, and he stopped every 12 miles between Middletown, Vermont, and what was called Willink, New York. Well, there's a little town called Brutus near Skaneateles, if you know the lake regions of New York, and I couldn't find Brutus. And I was staying in a bed and breakfast, and this woman got on the internet and said, oh yes, there is, it's in Weedsport, and she gave me all these back roads, and it's raining, I couldn't find it, and I'm all very frustrated. So why would he be this far off the Genesee Trail?
Right.
So I'm driving down the road, and I see Brutus Historical Society.
Okay.
And I was heading for the town hall to look for land deeds. So
yeah.
I stop, and the doors open, and I hear these voices in the back,
mm-hmm.
and I kind of come in, and there are three women sitting there. And I introduce myself, and I just said, I'm looking for information on my great-great-great-grandfather, Elbro Foster. According to his diary, he stayed in the Phelps cabin in Brutus. And this was in 1811. Well, they all lit up, flew to the corner mm-hmm. of the room, and I can't remember which one grabbed the picture first, but they pull up this painting
mm-hmm.
of a cabin. And they said, the Phelps family donated this picture yesterday.
I can't believe that. I get little goosebumps just thinking about
and
that.
I had no appointment. I didn't know if I'd be there.
Yeah.
You know, and there it was.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because the different places I went, I had extra copies of the diary
mm-hmm.
pages and left them so there are files. I felt like Johnny Appleseed as I went through this, you know, leaving Ichabod's writing in places where he had been. But
mm-hmm.
that happened to me several times where I don't know why I was there at that time. I often said, I might be riding shotgun. Someone else is driving this car.
I got goosebumps again. I love this kind of stuff. Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about just your writing in general. I know that you have a journalism degree, so what inspired you to study journalism? I mean, have you been writing since you were eight or something like that?
I think I started writing for the high school newspaper, Franklin mm-hmm. High School in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, that is now a junior high school. Miss Leiter was my journalism teacher, and for some reason I took it as an elective in ninth grade. And she really believed in me. Mm-hmm. And I can remember writing an article, kind of an editorial, about let's put Christ back in Christmas. Now, this was in 1951.
Wow.
And so, you know, and I got a lot of response mm-hmm. from that, and I was really encouraged. And then I used to go in the summers to camp in Minnesota, your home state.
Really?
Yeah.
And oh, that's right. There's no lakes in Iowa.
No, there are no lakes in Iowa. That's so. And my counselor, one year, had majored in journalism at Kansas State. Mm-hmm. And I really respected her. She was my sailing teacher. I probably never would have learned to sail without her. So she was also an influence in encouraging me to write. It never really came naturally to me because I'm really dyslexic. It's hard to read. I mean,
really?
My eyes want to go right to left rather than left to right. So I'm not an avid reader because it's always been difficult. But
I
did feel when I wrote something and it was recognized, there's a great reward in it. I mean, and I think that's probably just strokes kept me going.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved, you know, I ended up going to the University of Colorado initially because I really wanted to ski more than study anything else. And so yeah. I realized after my sophomore year, if I was going to be serious about journalism, I might as well go back home to the University of Iowa that has all the good writing programs.
That's right.
So that's where I graduated and did the typical thing, newspaper writing.
Mm-hmm.
That was the vogue. There, you know, when you think of 1954 and the opportunities for women then, and I married Rip shortly after that. We just had our 50th wedding anniversary this year.
Oh,
and that was the era where you followed your husband when he moved. And we
yes.
were married, lived in Fresno. I worked briefly for the Fresno Bee. Before I knew it, I was in New York. Then working for the Macy chain of papers, and then I started having a family.
Yes. And the writing kind of stopped.
That all stopped. Yeah, or
yes.
you're doing it as a volunteer,
yes.
you know, but the
yes.
seriousness of it was
yes.
gone. I mean, I just couldn't really follow a career in it.
So it wasn't until after you retired here on Lopez, really, that you started kind of writing for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the most personal writing that you have done.
That's true.
To me.
Yeah. I think a lot of us write journals that we wish we'll probably burn before we die.
I'm going to burn mine.
Just, you know, but that, you know, that's the great, the free write, you know, the
yeah.
journal in the morning
yeah.
when things are peaceful, that you can get some of the feelings out. But, yeah, that was the hardest shift in writing this book, was to get myself, you know, as the sharing the protagonist seat with Ichabod.
But now that you've done it, is it going to be easier to do more of it? Like you just hinted a little while ago that you'll write an article about, you know, this recent trip. And will that be similar? Will it be memoir?
It will be personal, probably happier. It doesn't start on a negative. It starts on a
mm-hmm.
real positive, and I'm just kind of formulating how that might fit together. But
mm-hmm.
now I'm, you know, crushed with the work after writing when you publish a book.
Yes, after you have the book.
The marketing.
The baby is born, and now you've got to raise it up and get it out there in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's right. That's the challenge. Because that you don't think about that. When you're writing the book, you're so engaged in it, and then you want to figure out, how am I going to get it published?
Mm-hmm.
And this book is a hybrid.
Mm-hmm.
I had a publisher say, yes, but take you out of it and make it third person. And after I'd written it, that would take a chunk out of what I'd done. I just couldn't do it that way. So it involves me. It involves then Ichabod and the interspersing the diary
mm-hmm.
throughout the book. And then the diary entries led me to the American history.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the evolution of the book. And I ended up publishing it then with Book Surge, which is a publishing part of Amazon. They are part of the Amazon company. And I've had a very positive response with them, and then I have control of the book, but it means a whole lot more work.
Yes, it does, but then you have choices, and mm-hmm. you can kind of control its mm-hmm. destiny. So, yes, and you're mm-hmm. not afraid of hard work, Julie, I know you.
Well, speak for yourself, Lorna Reese.
No.
I know you too.
Well, stop that. Okay, so could we hear a little bit more from your book now?
All right.
You might want to read you can read a longer section, a few shorter sections. Just
mm-hmm.
set us up before
yeah.
you
Well,
start.
What I'm will read now is the chapters. I think what I'd like to do is just read the chapter titles and then tell you which one I'm going to read from.
Okay.
So we go from the prologue, and then chapter one is entitled Land Without a Name, and this takes Ichabod from Coventry, Rhode Island, where he was married, to Vermont, when Vermont was not Vermont.
Not a state.
Not a state. It was land. It was part of New York, according to New York, and it was part of New Hampshire, according to New Hampshire. So he ends up with an Albany, New York land deed along Otter Creek, which is now Rutland, and then runs into all the land fights. And
yes.
Ethan Allen is in his diary and in the book, because Ethan Allen was for the New Hampshire grants.
Yeah.
So the first chapter, from history perspective, talks about these land fights. Then chapter two is entitled Backwaters of the Revolution, and leads into what was happening with his family during the Revolution and where Ichabod's father fought. And, you know, these skirmishes in where it was just a wasteland, because they had Hessians, Indians, and the British, and they were burning everything. And some of the people, you know, just ran back to Connecticut. They, but the Fosters stayed there in the backwaters of the Revolution. Then chapter three, an 18th century farm. And these are the scenes when I'm in the farmhouse with Belle Senegal the first time in 1992 when her husband was still living.
And she's the one who bought the house
she's
in 1942.
The one, that's correct,
okay.
1944.
40.
Yeah, and then she, and so then this is my return visit to her as we're going along, and then I follow. Then the next chapter, and it goes into the birthing scenes, because there's a mysterious birth in this diary.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, whose child is this?
Yes.
And so we go into those scenes and what it was like in the farming life. And that's what takes place in the 18th century farm chapter. Then the next one is Ichabod and his faith, because he really had a rhubarb with the Baptist and left Whiting and moved to Middletown that later became Middletown Springs, Vermont. And I was able to get the minutes of those church records starting in 1787 with his name in it, and he's excluded, and he had a fight.
Oh, my gosh.
So that gives me an opportunity to talk about what religion was like in the time.
Yes.
And then the next one is West to Willink. Willink was the section along Lake Erie that was owned by the Willink brothers in Holland. And the original land deeds for that are still in Holland. But
really?
There are copies at Fredonia University, which I used extensively for this. But this one then takes Ichabod across from Middletown to Willink, where he settled with his son. And the last mile goes through the horrendous arrival and the snowstorm and all. And chapter 7 is Ichabod's burial. I'm going to save that as a surprise about how we handle that. And the epilogue is the migration of the diary, what actually happened to this diary that goes from 1785 to 1813. And what I'd like to do is just read a section when I've left I've left Whiting, left the Senegal, you know, the old farmhouse, and I've gone to Middletown.
Okay.
And this is where, this is the scene in the chapter on Ichabod and his faith.
Okay.
Middletown Springs is like many whitewashed Vermont towns that grew up around 1790 and hardly grew again. Its largest population was 1,068, recorded the year before the first flood. Ichabod had moved, following his disagreement with the Orwell Baptist Church, with his faith apparently intact. The community has one all-purpose store where residents buy milk and butter and day-old newspapers. The trees on the surrounding mountains are bare. Dead leaves from oak and maple, birch and ash await the first snow for burial. I park in the lot next to the white colonial-style church and climb the steps, smiling at the parishioners whose eyes tell me they wonder where I came from. They nod, say nothing. I remember Grace telling me strangers aren't hard to spot in these parts. Middletown boasted two churches when the first flood washed away the town's businesses. Today there is one. Is this Ichabod's Baptist Church? I slip into a pew near the back, hoping no one else will notice me. My knees bend toward my chest, reminding me that people were shorter 2 centuries ago when this church was built. I feel a tap on my shoulder. A bubbly, round-faced woman leans over the pew. "What is your name?" she whispers. She tells me hers and introduces her husband, a trim Englishman wearing a white tennis sweater of the 1950s with a red geometric pattern tie tucked inside. His sideburns and handshake convey a sense of importance. A young man strums an electric guitar and leads a four-piece combo through contemporary versions of traditional hymns. Children scamper up and down the aisles. A baby squirms in her mother's lap in front of me. About 50 people are worshiping in a space that could hold 300. Suddenly the walls reverberate with, "Holy, holy, holy, Lord God Almighty." I sing as loud as I can, as if I want all my ancestors who worshipped in Middletown to hear me. If I sing and pray and read scripture where Ichabod did, will I feel my roots reaching deeper into our shared connection? I hope the power of the old pipe organ conceals my exuberance. I doubt that Ichabod heard organ music in the Baptist meeting house 192 years ago. I don't know if his small congregation could even afford the services of their minister, the Reverend Sylvanus Haynes, who married my great-great-grandparents, Elbro Foster and Rispadone. 15 June, 1806, Elbro was married in the after part of the day. When it comes time to lead prayers and offer a few inspiring words, the sporty Englishman sitting behind me steps forward. He's their reverend. After his sermon is over, he looks at me and asks, "Would you mind telling us who you are and why you are here?" People turn. I want to sink into my pew, but my knees won't bend anymore. I can't hide from his question. I lick my lips as I fumble with words to frame a reply. Nothing is simple for Ichabod and me. "I'm from Lopez Island, Washington," I say. "My great-great-great-grandfather attended the Baptist meeting services here in the early 1800s before he moved west." I'm an oddity in this small back mountain town, a woman traveling alone. Not many people come through this tiny community at the base of Haystack Mountain, laced with grade 4 gravel roads leading to communities even smaller. Soon the story I have repeated often on my journey flows with ease like a stream in spring. "His family lived up the mountain road behind this church, the one leading to Ira," I say. "Ichabod helped build the Middletown Baptist meeting house. His diary says he carved pins for the structure." I mention neighbors named in the diary, wondering if any descendants live here now. "He left Middletown with his wife and two of his children 192 years ago, I say. Oohs and ahs erupt from women wearing simple hats. Eyes hang on every word. Will Ichabod be the centerpiece of next Sunday's sermon? I'll leave this afternoon to trace his route west to Willink in western New York. A baby starts to cry. I thank them for listening and sit down. The Reverend leads us in a closing prayer and the benediction. Young couples and elderly women shake my hand as we file out. "I'm a Carr. I wonder if we are related," asks one young mother. "Be careful," says a white-haired woman wearing a wool coat. "You know there is a Foster Road right up where your property was," says a teenage boy. A man wearing a flannel shirt, Levi's and boots, stands back until everyone else has passed. He doesn't seem to have family in church. "You want to see the old Baptist meeting house of your ancestors?" he asks. "It's right across the street." His brown eyes twinkle as if he has a secret to share. Does he mean this white church was not the one Ichabod attended? I feel sad as I slip past the few people standing by the front door and follow his quick steps across the commons. I don't remember seeing another building resembling a church when I arrived. He turns to me as we cross the road. "That's it," he says, pointing to a blue shingled two-story structure, no door, no steeple. The building looks neglected. I don't know what I feel. Shock? Disappointment? "The Baptist Society sold it to a potato farmer in the 1930s, he says. "He stored potatoes inside for years until I bought it." We walk around back. The wind tosses leaves around stacks of old barn boards. Crows cackle in the branches overhead. Slivers of white ice are forming along the edges of a puddle beside the building. "I restore barns," he says. "Come, I'll show you inside." The barn-like door won't slide. He runs back to the church to find the man who last had the key. I follow. "Can I change into Levi's and boots in the church restroom while you search for the key?" I ask. "Sure. I'll show you where it is and meet you back here." He is digging in the dirt beside the door when I return. "I'm looking for the key," he says. "It's supposed to be under this bucket." I kneel on the ground and dig under the leaves. My hair and skin feel oily. The inn had no hot water this morning. I smile, remembering that Ichabod and Susanna probably bathed only once a year. I keep digging. Dirt cakes under my nails. "What's your name?" I ask. "Dan McKean. Did you know this building was built in 1816? "No, it wasn't," I reply. "Ichabod's diary said it was raised in 1806. I can show you. I have a copy of that diary page." And this goes on, my involvement with him and the stories. And he and his wife are the ones who housed me when I was in Middletown on the book tour. It was such fun to get back there, and he did all the publicity. But
you made lots of friends along that way, didn't you?
I feel like I did, and I'm lucky because it's meeting the living and the living relatives that I met in this whole search that also keeps the whole story alive for me.
Well, we're coming up on the limits of our time today, so I'd like to just sum up what we've been talking about. Ichabod is missing. Julie Van Camp sets out to solve the mystery of the disappearance of her ancestor 200 years ago. Using his diary from the late 1790s and early 1800s, she digs beneath primary source materials to uncover universal themes of death, birth, religion, survival, and war. People she bumps into while traveling through Rhode Island, Vermont, and New York reinforce her sixth sense encounters. Ancestors live among us so long as they are remembered. Released this spring by Book Surge Publishing, Searching for Ichabod, His 18th Century Diary Leads Me Home, is 229 pages, including endnotes and bibliography. And you can buy this book locally at...
You can buy it at Phyllis's, and there are stores in Friday Harbor that will be handling it, and I'm just still in negotiation with them. You can also buy it. Ichabod has a web page.
I don't know if he would
approve of that, but he has a web page. So you just go www.searchingforichabod.com, and you can read the articles that I've written prior to this by the publishing of the book, and you can also order the book that way through PayPal that accepts anybody's credit card. You don't have to be a PayPal member, and it's also available on Amazon.
Thank you. I was going to ask you about the website. There's some lovely pictures there as well.
Yeah, they're diary pictures, and I have given the diary to the New England Historic Genealogical Society in Boston for their manuscripts department, so it is preserved. It is extremely fragile, but I have copies that have blown up pages.
I bet your family is pretty proud of the fact that it's going to be taken care of, preserved for ever.
Yes, yes. The book will tell you a lot about the diary and about, it's in two parts. The second diary, which is at the end of his life, the original, is still in someone's underwear drawer in Beverly, Kansas.
Really?
And he will not part with it. And he is a distant relative, but that's in the migration of the diary, how that part of the family ended up with the diaries. But no way, he's saving that part. But even, I don't know what, but we have copies, and the copies are, it's available in various libraries in New England as well. So anyone who wants to research the diary contents can do so.
So it's to be continued.
To be continued, right. I may arrive in Beverly again and say,
because we didn't even get a chance to talk about the bones, but those of you who are intrigued will have to read the book to find out about that. You've been listening to Lopez Writers Read on KLOI FM 102.9. This program is being pre-recorded. Thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, I like to say, write on.